My name is Daisha Clay. I'm the audio librarian here at Classical 91.7. While I'm a real librarian, I have a deep, dark
secret.
I know very little about classical music. I grew up listening to rock, and I know something about jazz. But when it comes to classical, but I really want to learn. So, every week on this show, a classical music expert will give me a piece of classical music they think I should know, and then we'll discuss it. Come learn with me in the classical classroom. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Classical Classroom. I'm Daisha Clay, and here with me today is composer Mark Buller. His music has been performed all over the world, including here in our humble burg of Houston, at places like the Menil Collection and the Wortham Center. He has a master's in composition, but that wasn't enough for him, so he is now pursuing a DMA at the Morris School of Music at the University of Houston. He's been commissioned by many organizations, such as the Houston Grand Opera, to write work for them, which is what commissioned mean. I don't know why I said that. and he made his Carnegie Hall debut in 2012. Mark, welcome to Classical Classroom.
Thank you for having me.
So what are you going to be teaching me about today?
Today we're going to be talking about the motet, okay, which is a piece for choir. If we ever look up the definition of the word motet, if you ever go on Wikipedia, you'll probably see that it's a very loose definition. Uh-huh. It can mean a bunch of different things depending on which era we're talking about.
Okay.
And I think that's what makes it so interesting, too, the fact that it meant so many different things to different people.
Yeah, and when we kind of talked about it a little bit beforehand, mm-hmm, the thing that you seemed to like about it was that it's been around for so long.
Goodness, yeah.
And has moved through all of, like, musical history. Mm-hmm. So, okay, what is it?
Well, there's a British musicologist named Margaret Bent, and she defines it as a piece of music in several parts with words, which is not very specific, obviously. We look at that, and that could be anything, really.
Yeah.
Any choral piece. And the reason for that is, yeah, it has changed so many times, but okay, it's a piece that's just full of contradictions. For every definition I give, someone listening would be able to say, but wait, there's also such and such.
Huh.
So there are secular motets, sacred, there are motets for three voices, there are motets for 40 voices. So, it changes as time goes on.
So you think her definition is pretty...
I think it's what we'd better stick with for
okay.
now.
Okay. Yeah. Stick with the simplest.
Right.
All right. So why did you feel like it was an important concept to...
Well, it's because it changes so often, we can sort of trace all of music history through it. Uh-huh. There are motets for pretty much every period of music history.
Okay.
So it's just a fantastic way of, like, having a window into composers' minds throughout the centuries.
Yeah.
So I think we'd better define, like, where the word motet comes from.
Okay.
So the word motet, people used to think it came from the Latin word movare, which means to move. Mm. But in the last few decades, they've done a little bit more research and found more sources which show it probably comes from the French word mot, which means word or phrase.
Uh-huh.
So we go way back, in our mind's eye, let's go back to the medieval era. There we go.
Okay, sorry.
There are these singer-songwriters called trouvères and troubadours. Trouvères were in northern France, troubadours were in south. They were poet-composers, and they'd go around singing at courts and, mm-hmm, you know, everywhere that anyone wanted to hear music. And they started to latch onto this idea of motets. So people like Adam de la Halle, I brought a piece by him. He lived in the late 13th century, died in, I think, 1309, sometime around there. Composer, poet, he wrote a play about Robin and Marian, Robin Hood and Marian, which is interesting that legend goes back so far.
Yeah, you know, that's crazy.
Late 1200s, it's really crazy. Do you speak French?
No.
Okay. All of our listeners who know French will probably tense up when they hear me attempt this, but this is a piece by Adam de la Halle called Mout me fou griffe le départir. Apologies to everyone who knows French and could correct me immediately on the spot.
You're safe with me.
Okay, thank you. Good. So let's listen to this. So he wrote a motet. So he took a line of chant, he put it in the tenor voice. We think of tenor as a high voice, but tenor means like to hold. It's a similar word in Spanish, to have or to hold. Mm-hmm. So the tenor would have that older chant voice. And then on top of that, you would just write whatever you wanted. So often mm-hmm. you'd have like a sacred chant line down there at the bottom, and then you'd have like secular text, like love songs, for instance, on top, which is really weird when you think about it. I mean, you can't really understand the text very well if you've got Latin in the bass and then like early French in one of the upper voices as
well. That's really weird.
It is really weird. They're called polytextual motets. It's a little weird to our ears.
Yeah.
It's a little jagged.
It kind of, you know, I said it was weird, but then I immediately thought, well, that's exactly what we do today, mm-hmm. like with sampling and things like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are these unholy combinations of like country music and hip hop and things
Absolutely.
Like that going on. And so people were already doing that.
They were.
Back then. What an interesting sound.
Yeah.
You were talking about how they were the troubadours and the
Trouvères.
Mm-hmm. So this music that we just heard, this is something that like people might be playing in the middle of a square or like...
Yeah, or in like a court of a nobleman or something.
Okay.
We might think of like a castle square, courtyard or something.
Yeah. So these were like the proto Bob Dylan's.
You know, that's not that far off, actually. Yeah.
Okay.
There's so many similarities.
Yeah.
You know, a man and a lute, you know?
Yeah.
Like a guitarist. Singing
a dude
along.
And a lute.
A dude and a lute. That sounds like a terrible band name.
It does. It's going to be Todd's band. Okay, sorry. I got you off track.
So yeah, that's basically the first half of the Middle Ages. We've got these guys traveling around, the troubadours and trouvères. And composers too. We have to remember composers were kind of trying to show off a little bit. There were brand new systems of notation that were just starting to take hold. Up to this point, a lot of the music was, I mean, you just learned it orally.
Uh-huh.
Music was written by a lot of illiterate people. Uh-huh. You know, there was no way of writing it down.
Yeah.
I mean, you could sketch, you know, like the contour of a line sometimes to remember, for instance, Gregorian chant. But it took a little while for theorists and for philosophers to come up with a good system of writing it down. So this piece we just heard, there was a definite rhythm. You could almost find the beat. You might not really tap your foot very easily, but you felt kind of a pulse in the music. And that's because around this time, they started using what are called rhythmic modes. So mm-hmm. rhythmic mode is a repeating idea.
Yeah.
We think of the Middle Ages as being just a dark era. It's not exactly true. There were a lot of really great things going on. Of course, the printing press hadn't been invented yet, so all those poor monks had to copy everything by hand.
Oh, poor guys.
Yeah. But there was a lot of knowledge that was going on in monasteries and churches and convents even. So yeah, that aside. into the Ars Nova, there's something called isorhythm. That was the next big thing. So isorhythm is... You take that rhythm and you repeat it over and over and over, and then you take a melodic figure and that repeats over and over, but the two don't line up.
Uh-huh.
Kind of a cool thing they were doing at that time. That's the next piece I brought. It's by a man named Philippe de Vitry.
Mm-hmm.
So he was a scholar, a composer who coined the term Ars Nova, which means new art, by the way. He recognized that composers in the 1300s were doing something completely new than those out of fashion people in what he called the Ars Antiqua. So he took this new system of writing down rhythms, wrote these much more complicated rhythms. I brought his most famous motet. It's an isorhythmic motet. And once again, the upper voices are the ones that are moving quickly and the lower voice is moving much more slowly.
All right.
Yeah. This is Gerit Gallus Flendu Dolorose. So the rhythm is a little bit stronger here.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think you can't help but smile with this music, too.
That's... Yeah. You know, what I really love is that the guy that you were just talking about, what was his name?
Philippe de Vitry.
Okay. I love that he was like, that other thing that we just heard a couple of minutes ago, that is old school, and this is new school,
mm-hmm.
and you people need to get with the program.
So three texts going at the same time.
Wow, that's pretty, yeah, it's very complex.
Mm-hmm.
Is it men and women, or is it...
This recording is just men.
Okay.
Most sacred music of this era would have been I should say all sacred music would have been just men.
Okay.
Because in the church, they never allowed women to sing to the men. So that was by Philippe de Vitry, a really great piece.
It's very buoyant.
It's extremely buoyant, yeah.
Bounces along.
Yeah, it does. So that's basically the height of what's called the Ars Nova, then the last of the medieval era. Polyphonic music, and I should define that really quickly, polyphonic music as opposed to monophonic music. Polyphonic music is when you've got several individual voices and none are more important than the other. Today, in a lot of our music, there's a melody and there's accompaniment. That's homophonic. But this is polyphonic music where all the voices are of more or less equal importance.
It's very democratic.
Extremely democratic, yeah. Now, polyphony would reach a height in the Renaissance era. So that's around 1400 to 1600. You couldn't really understand any of the words, right?
Yeah,
they were singing. Even if you spoke Latin, I mean, it'd be really difficult to tell with all of this dense polyphony, this really dense web going on.
Yeah.
So the story goes, and there's probably some truth to it, but Pope Marcellus around this time, around the 1550s, early 1560s, wanted to try to crack down on this because, I mean, this is sacred music. We want the words to come across and to, you know, affect people. And here these composers are just showing off, doing all sorts of fancy things, showing how good they are.
Right.
So he apparently threatened to ban all of this and make it go back to just the sort of Gregorian chant sort of thing. So composers obviously kind of panicked, right? Because this is their livelihood. This is how they're showing how good of a composer they are. The story goes that Palestrina, the next big composer, wrote a mass setting. So all of the individual movements of the mass and named it after Pope Marcellus. So that's gold star number one, right? He says, hey, check it out. I'm going to write this really good mass and name it after you. And then he wrote it so that you could more easily understand the words. So he pretty much started a new style of polyphony that said, here, let's make it so that we have this really beautiful polyphony, but so that people in the pews or people listening to this music can absolutely understand the words. I didn't bring anything from that mass, but I brought one of his motets. So this is a setting of the Song of Solomon. He called it Canticum Canticorum. Again, that's the Song of Songs, Song of the Singer.
And this is Palestrina that
we're
going
to
hear?
This is Palestrina. Okay. Mm-hmm. So this is the late 16th century, performed here by the Hilliard Ensemble. Mm-hmm. The English translation is, let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, and I'd better stop there or else you'll have to give a parental advisory. but we'll listen to this motet by Palestrina.
Okay.
Much calmer.
Yeah. It's like there's a room that's got several doors and they're all going in and out of them at different times.
Absolutely.
They're all coming into the same room.
That's precisely it.
That's so interesting.
It's very imitative. We talk about imitation in music. A good example people do is row, row, row your boat. Someone will start, and then later someone else comes in. That's precisely what they're doing.
Huh.
So that you can hear those entrances as they move around the choir.
So this piece is really an example of, creative, evolution, creative survival of the fittest. Because he was literally writing this to sort of save this form of music.
In a sense,
being squashed.
Now again, that's right. Again, it's kind of reductive, and those who are listening who have a good grasp of music history might say, well, that's not necessarily true. Maybe big picture, yeah, sure.
Okay.
But this new style had kind of took a step back. Music history is all about a pendulum, right? Mm. It's going back and forth. You know, people for a few hundred years will do one thing and it'll go back another way. This is a really good example. And again, that's why the motet is perfect for seeing this. Because we start off doing these crazy things and then we move back to a very conservative style here.
Yeah.
It's pure.
Yeah, it's very
refined.
Soothing.
Mm-hmm.
It definitely doesn't have that buoyancy.
Right.
Of the Ars Nova?
Yeah, Ars Nova. I should note as well, the ones before would have been sung usually more for fun. They weren't as likely to be done in church.
Yeah.
Whereas, while this, of course, isn't part of the liturgy, it's not the Kyrie, Gloria, Credo, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
There were some instances in which motets like this were done in churches, but this is more for, a sacred concert someplace, probably.
Gotcha, okay.
Yeah. So this is more of what we think of as the stereotypical choral music now.
Yeah.
The stuff before isn't really choral music. It's more a few soloists who got together and sang for fun. Mm-hmm. This recording we just heard is just one voice per part. So yeah, we reached this height of polyphony then in the Renaissance. This example we just heard of a sacred motet was in Latin, completely in Latin. In England, of course, in the Renaissance, if you're familiar with history in general, you know that it was a turbulent time as far as religion goes, with Catholic, Anglican, back and forth, Bloody Mary and Elizabeth and everything. Composers such as Thomas Tallis had to be really careful about not offending the ruling religious establishment at the time. And Tallis was a genius. I should note that the poor English were always behind the times. I mean, when there's no way of figuring out the musical fashions going on right now in France and Italy. Uh-huh. So, the poor British are a little bit behind. By 1600, the musical, more or less, capital of Europe and Italy had really moved on to the Baroque era. Uh-huh. But the English were still doing their thing. This next example by Thomas Tallis is one in English, actually. It's a really interesting example of a motet in the vernacular. Mm-hmm. And that speaks, again, to the reigning religion at the time. Mm-hmm. Catholicism at this time, everything was in Latin in the service. And, you know, Martin Luther, that was one of his big things he spoke out against. You know, you want the people sitting in the pews to be able to understand what's going on in the service. Mm-hmm. So here's an example then from Thomas Tallis. This is If Ye Love Me. Okay. There's another entrance. And they all end together again.
Wow. So the fact that Tallis wrote this in English, was he kind of trying to appease the religious, the kind of,
I think he was just trying to keep his job, probably.
Okay.
Because I mean, anytime there's a like a religious change.
Yeah.
I mean, it was complete. They, you know, all of the clergy are wiped out, and you install new ones, of course.
Yeah.
So Tallis was really brilliant, though. He managed to be such a good politician, and appease the important people of the time. He was always kind of kept through, which again speaks to his talent, of course.
Mm-hmm.
His Latin pieces are just as good as his English pieces, really? For instance. Yeah. So this style, then, of Tallis and Byrd maybe isn't quite as complex as Palestrina.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say it's not as good. It's amazing. It's beautiful. This piece by Tallis is one of his most performed pieces.
Uh-huh.
And then, so yeah, we could kind of argue the motet sort of reaches its height around this era with polyphony. After this, the motet begins to mean completely different things to different people. The next example I brought is by J.S. Bach, probably one of the most famous composers in all of classical music. Mm-hmm. Bach, of course, died in 1750, and he was always, I mean, his sons were composers who thought of him as painfully old-fashioned.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, poor guy. but he wrote several motets as well. Now, these motets are in German, so once again, the vernacular. They're Lutheran, which is what Bach was as well. Bach is probably the most important Lutheran composer of all time. The example I brought is Lobet den Herrn, alle Heiden, Praise the Lord, all you heathen,
mm-hmm.
Which is for choir and a small instrumental ensemble as well.
Does he kind of signal the beginning of the classical period?
Not yet.
Okay,
is the height, I want to say the height of the Renaissance. Uh-huh. Some people say Josquin. I'll say Palestrina for now and get in trouble later. Bach takes all of the 150 years of Baroque tradition, refines it, and comes up with like a diamond, really, the gem.
Gotcha. Okay.
Which is why his sons thought of him as old-fashioned, because by the time Bach died, the musical style in Europe was really changing.
Yeah.
But these motets then, I think they're the best Baroque motets.
Cool. Okay.
So imitative entries now.
Yeah.
So there's some similarities to the Palestrina. I mean, he's writing in the same polyphonic style. This is dense polyphony. There are the imitative entrances.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a stronger beat now. One of my piano teachers told me all Bach is dance music, and you feel that strong beat throughout.
Yeah.
The interesting thing, too, the motet at this point has become just a title, almost a vehicle for a composer to just write a polyphonic piece.
Mm-hmm.
And you see why at the beginning of the episode, we talked about how difficult it is to define it. And this is one perfect reason why.
Yeah.
Because if you just were to listen to an excerpt of this, there's no way to tell. Is it a cantata? Is it part of one of the Bach Passions or oratorios or something?
Mm-hmm.
It's just a standalone polyphonic piece in German. So there we go. So yeah, the last big kind of gasp of the Baroque era is Bach. And then, of course, we move into the classical era, you mentioned. So Beethoven, Haydn, Mozart are the big three.
Yeah.
The Viennese sort of thing going on. At this time, the motet wasn't really in vogue. There weren't all that many motets written. I brought one important example by Mozart. We have to remember that composers are looking to write bigger and better things. So people like Haydn wrote the three oratorios, like The Creation and The Seasons, Mozart Requiem. If you want to write like polyphonic music for choir and orchestra, you're going to do something like a Requiem.
Mm-hmm.
Beethoven wrote the two masses that are his sort of throwback, like you mentioned. But every now and then a composer would do that. So I brought the Mozart Ave Verum Corpus. Now we're going to hear how this is different, much different style. It's with accompaniment now.
Okay.
Again, strings and organ. So you can hear, there's not really an awful lot of polyphony then.
Yeah, I was going to say, everybody's sort of singing the same line.
At the same time, right.
Yeah.
Still in Latin, though.
It's back to that sort of slow, soothing,
Now, Bach does this sometimes in the motets, of course. We could find examples that are like slower and soothing from each.
Yeah.
But this is, I mean, it's very Mozart.
It's
cream, sort of. It's very beautiful. There's
like the butter. As they say about Mozart.
As they say.
Yeah.
As they all say.
Yeah.
So again, we've gone a whole new different direction now.
Yeah. There's such a huge difference between this and
everything before it.
Yeah, and everything before it. I mean, it's like a completely different mood.
Mm-hmm.
It's a completely different emotional expression.
Sure. Mozart could have almost written this exact same thing for just strings and winds.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this could be a slow movement from one of his symphonies,
mm-hmm.
and it would have worked perfectly fine.
Sounded.
Compare this to the madrigal. So the madrigal we talked about, throughout history, the madrigal tends to be more of a unified sort of thing. Or the concerto, like the concerto as a specific form or genre in music.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a concerto is always a piece, soloist and orchestra, very virtuoso. You're going to have usually a big introduction with the orchestra and then a great big grand entry. So, I mean, as we like study classical music and try to become versed in the genres and forms, that helps because we see the word concerto on the program. We know what to expect. You see the word motet and it's much more open-ended.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a motet surprise. It could be anything.
Right. The grab bag, one of those mystery bags.
Right.
Yeah. We get into the 1800s, especially late 1800s, early 1900s, kind of the last thing of the Romantic era.
Mm-hmm.
Composers are really pushing harmony. We're getting much more complicated harmonies. So we get to Richard Strauss, who is the famous opera composer who wrote Salome and Elektra and Rosenkavalier. And he wrote everything. Goodness, he wrote orchestral pieces and chamber. But he wrote Deutsche Motette, so German motets. So you're getting these really dense harmonies. It's really tough to sing. The Mozart is done, I've heard it sung by middle school choirs, because it's, I don't want to say it's easy, but you can learn the notes, they fit into the scale nicely.
Yeah.
Right? Everyone moves at the same time.
It's simple.
It's relatively simple.
Yeah.
Now, this Richard Strauss example is extremely difficult. You could go to choral concerts every week your entire life and would be lucky if you heard this somewhere. Okay. Some of the better choirs in the world occasionally will attempt it. So, like the examples we've heard before, there really have been no more than four or maybe five individual lines. Mm-hmm. But if composers are trying to show off or write a more complicated harmony, you're going to add a lot more.
Yeah.
An example I didn't bring is by Thomas Tallis, who wrote Spem in Allium, which is a motet with 40 individual
Whoa.
Parts. Yeah. The score is like 2.5 feet high.
I'm
not kidding, yeah.
Oh my God.
The famous Spem in Allium. So Richard Strauss was a little bit of a slacker. He only wrote for 20 individual parts.
Come on.
It's still extraordinarily difficult because the harmonic language he's working in is much more difficult. Let's take a listen.
Okay.
This is two choirs, a choir of Gonville and Caius College in Cambridge and the choir of King's College.
Okay.
So he's dialoguing with tradition. You hear the imitative vocal entries?
Uh-huh.
People come in and kind of stick out of the texture for just a minute.
Yeah. And then they kind of hop back into the flow.
Yeah. I think of fish in a stream almost. You know, it's this rippling texture,
yeah.
And then there's one that will jump out every now and then.
Is that, would you say, a defining characteristic of the motet?
Of polyphony in general, yeah.
Of polyphony
sure.
in general, okay.
Absolutely. I mean, they're singing with vibrato here. That's much more
that's
germane
new.
To the style. Yeah. That's performance practice, of course. Strauss didn't use vibrato. But it's a wrought emotional style now.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas before, we kind of like glide along the surface almost.
Right.
It's very, I mean, there's a climax to the piece, sure. But it's all very like zen, sort of. It's for meditation.
Mm-hmm.
These are more intended for concert performance now.
I see.
So you need that drama.
Yeah.
That's a huge range now.
Yeah.
Basses are really low. The sopranos are very high.
And this is 20 people.
20 individual parts.
20 yeah. parts, okay.
So you need a choir of probably 40 or 60
okay.
to make it work. Although, obviously, you can do it with just 20 if you have brave singers. So Strauss was German. This is a very German Teutonic piece.
Mm-hmm.
It's what we'd expect to hear from, you know, Wagner, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Not this, of course, not this piece in general, but that sort of style. So now the motet, now in the 20th century, it's become, again, more of a vehicle for composers who say, hey, I want to write a piece for choir. I want it to conjure this historical image in the ear, I guess, of the listener, but dialogue with that tradition a bit.
Okay. So
and that's what classical
back.
Music, yeah, the throwback. That's
yeah.
what classical music is too. You know, like when a composer writes a concerto now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, poor guy, there are 400 years of concerti that are conjured up in the listener's mind that he has to fulfill those expectations and then work against them, and hopefully in a way that can work well. I brought two more examples. One is by Morten Lauridsen. So Lauridsen is a composer who is famous, one of the most famous choral composers alive today, especially among Americans. He's an American, lives on the West Coast. So he wrote a motet, O Magnum Mysterium, which, O Great Mystery and Wondrous Sacrament, that animals should see the birth of Jesus lying in the manger. Hallelujah. So it's a Christmas, appropriate
okay.
for Christmas, of course. This is the Vasari Singers with Jeremy Backhouse.
He's really embracing that style of the
beautiful
just,
harmonies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And he's even There's no musical accompaniment. Mm-hmm. There's acapella. It's just sort of...
It just kind of, it floats.
Yeah. And this composer is still living?
He is.
Okay.
Just a gorgeous piece, and that's his music is all like this.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you'll notice too, whereas in earlier eras the harmony isn't always teleological, that is goal-driven, we're not working toward a climax. Morten Lauridsen, you heard in the Strauss, and Mozart too, of course, but they're always working toward a climax or working back away from it. There's this ebb and flow with the musical tension in the piece, and it's part of what makes the piece so convincing, I think, to audience members and singers alike. Singers love singing this piece. Those little clashes you hear in the harmony, that's just so much fun. If you can lock in with the person who's singing the note clashing with you, it's a great feeling as a singer.
Yeah.
Right there.
I love that swell. Mm-hmm. And
then it clears up.
Yeah.
And the tension is released now.
Mm-hmm.
This is from 1994,
okay.
And if I'm not mistaken, it's his most performed piece.
Yeah. That's lovely.
Mm-hmm. One of the most beautiful pieces I've ever heard.
Yeah, that's really nice.
It's fantastic.
Yeah.
It's hard to follow that up with
anything. Yeah, what else you got after that?
Well, it is the job of the composer to ruthlessly and tastelessly self-promote. So, of course, I brought one of my motets. This is from 2009. I wrote five motets. Mm-hmm. This is the first of them. It's O Nata Lux, O Born Light. This is a text that goes back, goodness, to the beginning of where we started today. The text was written back when people like... Adam de la Halle were writing their crazy things.
Uh-huh.
So as a composer, I mean, that history that you dialogue with is fascinating to look at and to listen to all these pieces. Many composers have set this. Thomas Tallis, again, did one. So I wrote a motet, and it's only a motet in the sense that the text was set as a motet by other composers. It's not terribly polyphonic. People generally move at the same time, and it's with piano. But hopefully I tried to evoke that sort of cathedral, you know, dark cathedral feel, I guess.
Yeah. All right. Let's see what you've done with this motet thing.
With a little bit of the nod to the Renaissance modes. Those are the church modes, the scales they would have used back then. They didn't really work in major or minor. Uh-huh. You had these kind of half and half things.
I thought that it sounded familiar. But I love the piano. It's very haunting.
It becomes a character.
Yeah.
The dialogue is back and forth.
Thank you. That was awesome.
Thank you.
I really liked that.
Thanks. Yeah. So hopefully, like, I tried to nod to many of the eras before.
Yeah.
You know, it's the swell we saw in Durafley and Lauridsen and the Mozart.
Mm-hmm.
It ends on just the fifth, so we can't tell if it's major or minor, happy or sad, which is what they would have done in the Renaissance and mm-hmm. medieval eras.
That was one of my favorite pieces that we heard, well, actually. You can pay me that $5 later.
Okay.
Well, that was... Okay, so I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so will you read the definition that you read of motet at the beginning
yes.
again?
So, according to Margaret Bent, a piece of music in several parts with words.
Okay. So here's my question after hearing all of these motets. It is really hard to define what is the same about them.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder, do you think, and I mean, and clearly you do, because you've written one, but do you really think
no
that like the term motet, do you think it's still useful? We've seen this huge arc of evolution of these like vocal pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really hard. Even you were saying like at one point that it's really kind of hard to see the relationship between, you know, some of these earlier pieces and what came later.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think that term is still useful?
I think so. Much yeah. like Bach used it as a vehicle for basically what he wanted to do.
Uh-huh.
We can simplify it and say, why did Bach call it a motet in the first place?
Uh-huh.
You know, so I think the same question would apply to any of these. Mozart, for instance, too. I think motet now... Many people think of it as sacred Latin because all of the big motets were sacred and Latin and often unaccompanied.
Mm-hmm.
So we think of Tallis, Byrd, Palestrina.
Yeah.
Again, I said, remember, we talked about how it's sort of this genre of contradictions.
Uh-huh.
It's one there will always be another example.
Yeah.
If you say it's one, it's always sacred. Well, you can say, no, well, here's a secular one. But in general, I think we talk about how music today has to dialogue to the past by the titles and the forms we assign it to, which mm-hmm. I think is part of your question.
Mm-hmm.
Why motet then? I think because it dialogues with the height of the form
mm-hmm.
then back then in the Renaissance era.
Okay. Well, Mark, thank you so much for coming in today to teach me about this concept and showing me all of these different kinds of examples. It's been a great sort of historical march through
yeah.
like musical
800 years and,
yeah.
and however long it's
yeah.
been.
Wait, I said a great march through historic. I don't even know if that made sense. Great march through history.
There we go.
Via music.
The march
okay,
through history.
There I said things. All right, everybody, that about does it for this episode. For more Classical Classroom, go to houstonpublicmedia.org/classroom, where you will find a veritable cornucopia of ways to listen to and interact with us in social media, from iTunes to the Twitterverse. If you want to send me an email, you can do so at dclay@houstonpublicmedia.org, or you can send me a tweet. I'm at CC Dacia, that's DACIA. Thanks today to audio producer Todd Tween Hulslander for his skillful knob twiddling. Thanks to program director Sinjin Flynn for not regrowing a mustache. Thanks to Mark Buller for being here today. Thanks to me for saying words. But more than anything, thanks to you, listeners, for listening. We'll catch you next time.